All right, nothing like a little careless whisper to start off Monday sports talk. That'll certainly get you in the mood to talk sports, won't it, Mike Murphy?
Yeah, how's things in Houston?
Just totally ignore me. Okay, great. no, you should. You should totally ignore me.
Yeah.
Things were good. Things were good. By the way, welcome into KJ Sports Talk, Golf and More. Mike Murphy, the host. I'm just here to sit pretty, I guess, and be ignored. And I'm okay with that.
We have a good time. I missed you being here, but Ryan and I got through it. And it's just a shame we don't have anything to talk about today. I know you're coming back, and you've probably missed everything that you need to know, but we'll try to get through this program the best we can and see if we can't touch on a few things that happened while you're gone.
I saw Tiger Woods, yeah. I think it was the par four mm-hmm. fourth hole, mm-hmm. had, I think that was the hole, he had a par shot, and it just, like, rimmed out.
Yeah.
And he wound up bogeying when he had a, I think he had a birdie putt and a par putt on that same hole or something like that. But anyway, that's all the U.S. Open I saw.
I know. That's fine. It's I didn't miss a day. The U.S. Open is my favorite golf tournament because it is the U.S. Open. It represents the United States. You can qualify locally through the sectional and get to the U.S. Open. And, of course, obviously there's exemptions. But I always enjoy the week of the U.S. Open. It's not that I don't enjoy the Masters, not that I don't enjoy the British or the PGA. It's just the fact that it's always on a traditional golf course. And this year, you can't get any more traditional than going out and playing Pebble Beach for four rounds of golf and looking at the Pacific. I've had the opportunity to play out there several years in a row in the Spalding tournament, and it's my favorite part of the country. And I can sit there and watch the TV and enjoy those 4 days as much as any 4 days I watch golf. And obviously, you know, when you start looking at Pebble Beach, you remember Tom Watson's chip in on the 17th hole. You remember Tom Kite chipping it in on the 7th hole. You remember things that happen at Pebble that you never forget. And this is also one of those moments that we're going to remember a long time, because we had a young man that's been close in a lot of tournaments. He's played in the last group he's not won.
Mm-hmm.
And Midwestern young man, and it was really something to enjoy this weekend and watch Gary Woodlands have the lead, hold on to the lead, and see the maturity that he had to face the stiffest competition, and had Koepka kind of overlooking his shoulder, who's won, by the way,
the last two. Yeah.
So
no three-peat for Koepka.
Yeah, it was it was kind of funny that he brought up a stat. The only other person prior to that was somebody back in 1914 won three U.S. Opens. So this would have been a record that was just unreal. But as the tournament started, I really did think that Tiger stood a real, real good chance, And he never really, really got it going. He played well. And, of course, you had Phil Mickelson, who was trying to win the Grand Slam. And winning the Grand Slam at his age is very difficult. He ended up being three or four over. Tiger was two under. Tiger shot 69 in the last round. But the story belongs to Gary Woodland. It belongs to Koepka, Justin Rose, and the man that won the 2010 U.S. Open, forget his name right now, I'll remember it here in a minute, the Irishman. You had 2000 where Tiger set the record, and you had the 2010, and he played very, very well. I forget his name right now. Graham McDowell.
Oh, McDowell, yeah.
Yeah. And he hung in there too. But all the drama came down to basically Sunday, mm-hmm. and you had Rose and you had Woodlands together, and then in front of them you had Koepka. And Koepka, you could just see that come the end of the round, he was going to be right there. And he hit just a beautiful drive on 18, and over to the left is the Pacific Ocean. And you sit there, and he hit a beautiful second shot, hit iron in there, and it took a kind of a high bounce, hit it back over the green, and then I was sitting there with Brian, and I said, Brian, I said, look, it's this simple. The hardest shot that Woodland's ever going to have to hit in his life will be on the 17th hole. It's about 212 into that hole, and it's an hourglass green, and he had the pin in the back. And you could tell he was nervous. It took him a little while to hit it, but he kind of bailed on it and left the shot over to the right at least 50, 60 foot. And I didn't know if he's going to putt it or chip it. And then Woodlands just nails it, and it looks like he's got a chance to make eagle and for sure birdie. Mm-hmm. But I hit a chip shot, and it rolled about 8 foot short, and then he missed it. Had he made that and gone to 11, and Woodlands had found a way of three-putting or not getting an up and down, there would have been tie going into the 18th hole. But I have never seen a man's composure in a major championship better than Gary Woodlands. And what a compliment to him to be 35 years old and to be able to win this major, because you don't get that many chances. And he hung on. He grabbed a hold of the steering wheel and hit 4-iron in off the tee and hit like 5-iron and hit it up there and made a putt and ends up being 13 under to Koepka's 10. But the crowds were fantastic. The only thing that was left out of Pebble Beach was the wind. And the only reason the scores were as good as you saw the scores was because the wind really did not blow. I've never seen 4 days out there where the wind did not blow. And
it's a golfer's blessing, huh?
Huh?
It's a blessing for a golfer.
Oh, absolutely.
No wind.
I mean, it's a nightmare in some ways when the wind. My brother called me, and he said, Mike, he said, I've never seen a hole this short. The neatest thing about Pebble Beach is how they designed it. When you look at the first six holes out there, you get to the seventh hole, and I take my hat off to the architect. It's only 98 to 120 yards, and it sits right down. It goes downhill to the Pacific. And how an architect had enough insight to feel, hey, man, I got to put a hole there. And he did, and it's just one of the most scenic golf holes that you'll ever see anywhere in the world. And people that have seen that hole have said the same thing. How could an architect figure out how to put a hole after you get done on six, going to seven, and you look down there and 110 yards, 120 yards, it sits right on the Pacific. But it's a breathtaking place. Someone said to me, if you've never seen it, I'd tell them, take a shot at it and get out there and try to play the golf course if it's on your bucket list. So I had Brian look at what it costs to play there right now. What do you think it is? It's a public course.
To play at Pebble Beach?
Yeah.
A round of 18 or a round
18
of
holes. What do you think it costs to play there? If I gave you the phone number and you called out there and said, I am the sports director at KJFF, I want to come out and play your golf course, talk about it, what do you think they're going to charge you?
$2,100.
No, it ain't that much. But
$1,200.
No, it ain't that much.
$800.
No, you're getting closer, though.
$600? $500?
Okay, here's the story.
That's not bad.
No, it's not. It really isn't. Here's the story. If you stay at their lodge, it's $500.
Uh-huh. Oh.
But if you don't stay at their lodge, it's $550.
Oh.
For one person. For one person.
Okay.
But, you know, it's well worth it. The 17-mile drive, in which you said you have been out there. You told me you're out there when you're younger.
Yep.
Yeah, it is a breathtaking experience. It's one in which if they hold the Open out there every 9 or 10 years, next year goes to Wingfoot, which is another great golf course. That's in White Plains, New York. I've been there.
Okay.
And Wingfoot. Two of the greatest – if you take traditional golf courses for the Open back-to-back, you can't beat Pebble Beach and you can't beat Wingfoot, which is up outside of White Plains. But spectacular venue. You sit in there was a young amateur that played at Oklahoma State that was 4-under. He tied Jack Nicklaus's record, too. You might look at his name. He was an amateur. I'm not sure I want to try to pronounce it. That's why I'm going to put it.
Is he from Norway?
Yeah, he's from Norway.
Victor Hovland.
Yeah, that's him.
Probably not how you pronounce it, but
that's okay.
Give it a shot.
But he plays at Oklahoma State.
Okay.
And he broke Nicklaus's record for the all-time low rounds as an amateur.
Okay.
And really good nice. Player. And yeah. He's from Norway and
cool.
Plays at Oklahoma State. And then there was another kid from Stanford that was, I believe he was 2-under. Real good player, another amateur. But our amateurs our amateurs are playing very, very well, obviously, and there's reasons for it. These kids, by the time they get out of college, are just tremendous, tremendous players. But the leaderboard, I was not surprised by it. Gary Woodlands, he was hoping that this day would come. He also referenced his experience last year with Tiger Woods at Belle Reve, which I thought was very interesting. Playing with Tiger in the last round, Tiger finished second. He played with him, and he felt that was a great help for him to be able to compete in the majors, watching him playing with Tiger. And he put more focus on himself and the experience rather than being all stressed out over it. You could see him. He enjoyed. He was looking around like, you know what, how lucky am I to be able to lead the U.S. Open, to be here at Pebble Beach, and then to win this thing. And great victory. He's a Kansas boy.
Okay.
And he's from Kansas, and he talked a lot about him being a very good athlete, and everything came. He's a really good basketball player. I guess he played some football and baseball. He's a big guy, but nice victory for him and his family, and he's going to make a great U.S. Open champion, and we want to keep an eye on him. I always thought he had the ability to win a major, but I didn't know if he had the poise to do that, and he got done Sunday on Father's Day.
Right. He also scored $2.25 million.
Well, that's not bad, is it?
I always focus on the money, don't I?
Yeah.
You're probably getting tired of
That's that's
it's a lot of money.
You got to realize that, you know, if you take 10 years to get there and divide that up.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, it's not as much money as you think. But on a given week, when you got everything going in the right direction, he won the U.S. Open. And my Father's Day, someone in my family said to me yesterday, he says, Grandpa, says, you really enjoy Father's Day, don't you? I said, sure I do. Number one, I got three wonderful kids and I got six great grandchildren, but the last round of the U.S. Open is played on Father's Day. And he said, well, what can I get you for next year for Father's Day? And I says, just another Father's Day sitting here watching the Open would be fine for me at my age.
There you go.
Yeah. So
easy enough gift.
Oh, I'd get a card and have every one of your kids call you, and you sit there and you watch the U.S. Open. You can't beat it.
Just to clarify a couple, not necessarily clarify, but bring up a couple of things you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Brandon Wu was the other amateur.
That's right, from Sanford.
Yeah, he started the final round 2-under. He wound up shooting a 3-over, 74 on Sunday, so he dropped to 1-over. And then the other thing you mentioned, that only one time in the history of the U.S. Open has a golfer won 3 straight.
That's right.
And you thought it was about the mid-1900s.
Willie somebody.
You're very close.
Willie McDermott?
No. You're halfway there, though.
It's Willie. Anderson?
There you go.
Willie Anderson.
From?
It's probably Scotland.
Yep, you got it.
Okay. And then, you know what? That's a nice record, but that's 1914.
No, 1903 to 1905.
He won 3 in a row.
Yep. So you were close. I mean, you were within a decade, which I would have been way off. So
yeah. But that's interesting, because in the modern day era, it just shows you how hard it is to win a couple back to back. And then he finished second. Do you realize Kepa's been second at the Masters, first at the PGA, and second at the Open?
Yeah. When the big tournament comes around, Brooks Koepka steps up his game, doesn't he?
Absolutely. And it's an interesting thing too. It showed on the screen how many guys finished second in the Grand Slam, you know? And that was interesting, too, the names of the guys on that list. But great tournament. Had a lot of fun watching it. And looking forward to next year at Wingfoot, because I know the golf course there very well, too.
One more major to go, right? The British.
Yeah, the British Open. It's 18th
through the 21st in July.
It's that old head, isn't it?
Yeah, the Royal Portrush Golf Club in Portrush, Northern Ireland. Is that what you said?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yeah, it's in Ireland. I've had the good fortune of being in Scotland, and I said that I'd get over Ireland someday, but Old Head is well known, and the British is going to be there.
Now you,
the corkscrews will be popping, and the boys will be having their lager over there at in the Irish pub, so it's going to be a great British Open.
You know, if a golfer is going to be participating in that, they might want to become a meteorologist and understand wind patterns and how they work, because it's probably going to be super, super breezy over in Ireland.
I am going to look forward to that, because first of all, it's in Ireland, and I'm not too sure how, and I want to look this up. I'm not too sure how many British Opens have ever been in Ireland, okay? That's something we can do as time goes on, but I don't think there's been many, or if there has been any, British Opens in Ireland.
And this is Northern Ireland.
Yeah,
so
Northern
it's
Ireland, yeah.
A little bit different.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's its own independent.
It'll old head. I've had a number. I've had some of my good friends have played there, and he said it's just phenomenal. Seaside Links, up in Northern Ireland, and we'll get a chance to make that the final one, and that will be in July. The nice part about that is you can get up in the morning, at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, mm-hmm. and then watch the finish of it by 10:30, 11 o'clock, if you enjoy getting up early in the morning.
I do not.
No. Then set your TV then.
There we go. It might take a little while to find out how many times the British Open or the Open has been in Northern Ireland.
I cannot remember. I cannot ever remember that. But we'll do a little research on that as time goes on and gets closer. But, you know, it's...
Yeah, it says here, the 148th Open will be played at Royal Portrush from mm-hmm. July 18th through the 21st. Marking a historic return to Northern Ireland for golf's original and most international golf championship after nearly 70 years. So it's been 70 years, a little bit more or a little bit less, I guess.
Neither one of us were there for that.
No, I don't recall it.
If anybody would have been, it would have been me because I'd have been two. So, anyways.
Over 70 years ago? Oh, yeah, I guess that's true.
Yeah. I'd have been two, but I wasn't over there when I was two.
What? You're 70-something years
72.
Old? 72. Really?
But that, to me, is very interesting, okay? Because it's in Ireland, and it's going to be up there working. Anything can happen up there, the weather-wise. So it's going to be an interesting event, and we'll see how that shapes up. But that'll be the last of the Big Four. And
yeah. I'm curious. Do you think that the odds makers for who's going to win a golf tournament take into consideration the wind that day?
Yeah.
Or the wind for
there's
that
no,
tournament?
There's no question in my mind it's an advantage for a guy like McIlroy, who's from Ireland.
Right.
McDowell's from Ireland.
Can have the crowd behind him, too.
That, yeah, you take any European people, yes. There's no... See, the Americans struggle over there.
Yeah.
It just... It depends if you get them in a warmer climate that's a little south, you know, in Scotland or south in England. But when you start getting up the northern part of England and northern part of Scotland and northern part of Ireland, boy, you can get some nasty weather. And you got to get used to that. And that's something you don't get used to unless you're raised in it.
Right.
So it's going to be a lot of fun. I always enjoy the British Open because it's unlike any other event we have. Between the weather and the golf courses and everything else, it's a lot of fun to watch.
And Francesco Molinari will be
he'd
defending
be another
his
one.
Title. Yep.
Yeah, he'd be. See, he's the type of guy that would Garcia could be good over there. A guy like, I'd have to put McIlroy because he's from Ireland. I mean,
right.
He's probably going to be your favorite over there, but we'll wait and see how he plays. He didn't play very good at Pebble. He won a Canadian Open, you know, the week before,
mm-hmm.
and then came back from there and struggled. So, shall we move on to another subject?
Almost. Just wanted to say that the last three majors, or two majors that Molinari has participated in, he's finished fifth, which was at the Masters, and then 16th at the U.S. Open. So he's got about a month to, you know, start finishing higher up a little bit in some of his results. And then we'll see if he can carry some momentum into the British Open.
I guess you said this week's tournament's the Travelers, eh?
Yeah, Travelers Championship, yep.
That's usually up in Connecticut, up at Hartford. I don't know. Is that showing Hartford there?
That is showing Cromwell, Connecticut. So
yeah, it's in Connecticut.
Probably.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, that's where you see the umbrella. That's where Hartford's. Now, that tournament there, we'll keep an eye on it like we do all of them, but you'll see a lot of guys not there, but you'll see some young person win his first tournament. That or some guy that's, you know, got a little age on him that hasn't played very well for the last 7 or 8 years, but, you know, that's... We'll miss a lot of the better players at Hartford.
All right. So do you want? We're going to take a break here, but do you want to talk about the Blues? Or the Cardinals, or my trip to Houston.
I think we.
You're the host. You're in charge.
No, I think we need to talk about the Blues.
Okay. I prefer that over the other two. Anyway,
I'm going to tell you that was. I've said it for years on this radio program that if they could ever win the Stanley Cup, this town would go crazy. And boy, they had a good time. And I know what your prediction was, and I know what mine was, and we'll talk about it after the break.
Well, I picked the Blues, but I don't remember. Did I say six or seven?
You said seven, and I said six.
Did I?
Yeah.
I got it right? I never get things like that right.
Oh, yeah, you do.
Okay, I'll brag about it
Thing that surprised me is that game seven is hard to win. And I thought they could win in six. So I thought I had an advantage on you, but you pulled your ace out, and you predicted it. And I'll remind you how you did it, okay?
Okay.
All right.
I will do. All right. Break time. Matt Greenwood, Mike Murphy in the KJF studio with KJF Sports Talk, Golf, and More, powered by your local McDonald's. Tasty breakfast fast where your Egg McMuffin is always made with a freshly cracked egg. Another great reason to wake up to the favorites you love. Now, last time Mike Murphy was in the KJF studio, the St. Louis Blues were getting ready for Game 7 of the Stanley Cup Finals against the Boston Bruins. And now here we are on the Monday following that Stanley Cup championship for your St. Louis Blues. And we're here to talk about it. And 4-1 victory. And of course, everyone's heard by now, Mike. 4-1 victory. Couldn't have asked for a more dominant Game 7 from the St. Louis Blues than the one that they had Wednesday night. But as I told you off air, my mom was getting married back in Houston, and then we had dinner with the family afterwards. So I missed the whole thing, but hey, I did see the great celebration on the ice right after the game, and that gave me chills enough, you know?
There's a lot I want to bring up because, number one, you predicted the Blues to win in seven, and I said, to win on Boston's ice, I just don't believe that's going to happen. And then, number two, I said, I would think the Blues can win in six. So I kind of felt pretty good about it, but this season was so unpredictable. You know, I know, Matt, we're both hockey fans, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But to watch Stanley Cup hockey and to win that trophy, that to me is the hardest trophy of all major sports to win. It's such a grind.
Most everyone I talk to agrees with that sentiment.
Yeah, and I mean, that's my feeling about it. But
no, a lot of people feel that way. It really
is
quite tough.
You sit and watch. I enjoyed hockey in the 50s, 60s, 70s back in Detroit. Of course, you only had six teams.
Right.
So you only had to win eight games. Now, today, what would we have? One, two, three, four. You got to win, what, 16 games? And you play 28. That'd be right.
Yeah.
You play four. Mm-hmm. So you got to win, basically, if you go the full seven. But when I sit there, and I really have not been a Blues fan. It's not that I don't like the Blues. It's just I got used to Stanley Cup hockey. Well, this last month and a half has really got me back interested in hockey again, because watching Stanley Cup hockey, if you've got a team in the hunt, I don't believe there's anything any more exciting that you go through any more emotion in watching your TV and watching the guys play and getting familiar with the players. I'll be honest with you. If you had asked me during the show the last 2 months to name five players, I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
But I bet I can name 12, 13 of them right now.
Mm-hmm.
And when you go back, and this is a movie ready to be made, because you go back and they're in last place in January, and they fired their coach.
Mm-hmm.
And this Berube reminds me of the reason I really enjoyed this Stanley Cup hockey, because he reminds me of the way Stanley Cup hockey was played, and he coached it that way. You know, in this day and age, you deal with, in my opinion, a lot of prima donnas.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he got everybody to buy in to what he wanted. And this reminded me a lot of the way hockey was played back in the Stanley Cup. And after he got these guys going and seeing what took place here, everybody bought into his system. Everybody bought into his hockey. He beat an elite hockey team.
Mm-hmm.
When you start talking about cybermetrics, you start talking about numbers, you start talking about salary, this guy just went out and taught these kids, look, I want you to get to the puck. I want you to shoot it in. and I want you to play old style hockey. And by God, we got a chance to see it. And congratulations to the Blues. And to me, as an old hockey fan, you made me a new hockey fan.
I hope you didn't mind. I just kind of busted.
Yeah, no, yeah,
we're happy to have you.
But I was going to make a couple real quick observations. That thank you.
Yeah. You're welcome.
That Ryan and I've talked about. Yeah. Number one is the ticket prices. It just amazes me. I went to Game 4 in 1970 with my dad, and I saw them lose against Boston. So I was just a 10-year-old kid. So do the math. And ticket. My dad stood in line all night long because back then it used to be almost like bleachers. Tickets for the baseball game, you could stand in line to get the scraps, the leftover $3.75. Still have the ticket stuff.
How much?
$3.75.
That doesn't even buy a beer anymore.
Let me say that again. $3. There was two ticket prices, $4 and $3.75. Those were the ticket prices in 1970 for Game 4 of the Stanley Cup Finals. Okay, that it's just unheard of.
Almost 50 years ago.
I know. It's just unheard of. And the other thing I wanted to say, and Ryan had the luxury of going down to the parade, and I couldn't. We had a wedding Saturday, but I was able to watch it. And this was so great for the city. I mean, it really was. I mean, 500,000 people. I've been to both of the most recent Cardinal parades, 2006 and 2011, and then I went to the Rams parade in the sub-zero weather back in 2000. It must have been 30 degrees below zero wind chill on a Tuesday night or something like that after the Super Bowl on Sunday. And I just thought it was so cool because the Cardinals are a class act, okay? And they stay as a class act in the parade. They stay in the trucks, and they wave, and everybody tips their hat. The Blues, this was just a party. I mean, with all of them with beer cans and a lot of people, you know, I thought it was cool. But a lot of people were like, you know, they were getting liquored up and they're doing this and they're carrying the puck, but the Stanley Cup around and stuff. But everybody you talk to, because I can go both ways, everybody you talk to that was in the crowd thought it was so awesome. They were high-fiving, touching the Stanley Cup. It was just a different mindset, Mike.
Let me go back because I've been through this in Detroit. There's nothing any more down to earth than hockey players. They are blue collar.
They are.
They're a blue collar group of people.
They don't have a full set of teeth. Not one of them.
Right. Nope. They need a dentist. Every one of them is going to need a dentist after the Stanley Cup.
They spit teeth out and keep skating.
But what I said, this town will go crazy because we're a very blue collar town.
Yeah.
And
That's a good analogy. It's a great analogy.
It is. We're a great blue-collar town. So is Detroit. Okay. So when we win the Stanley Cup, I mean, you're talking about fans that go watch hockey that are paying it themselves. Don't get me wrong. There's corporate things that go on.
But not as much as there is in baseball.
Absolutely. Yeah. And when these guys – hey, I can tell you stories at Western Golf Club when I was at. Stroh's Brewing Company is a beer company that sponsors the Red Wings. We had the hockey players out there every year – and by 3 or 4 o'clock, there's a few fistfights going on.
Yeah,
and this is who they are.
It's just a different mindset. Yeah. And I remember growing up on Blues hockey with my dad, and I'd save my money and go to a Blues game. My dad always had Cardinal tickets. He worked for Commerce Bank in St. Louis, and he was like, oh, yeah. But when it came to hockey, he had some hockey tickets, but me and my buddies would just save up our money. It was more ingrained in where hockey – you didn't have a lot of the corporate seats and stuff back
then.
Right. You had people that scrounged. Even in today's day and age, you had people giving up their vacation. You had people giving up. You saw interviews with people that we gave up our family vacation to go on a cruise so we could afford $700 a seat, $800. I don't know if I would go that far to do that personally, but a lot of people did. And so I just thought it was cool. I mean, it was something that and what really it brings a city together because you have total strangers. And Ryan can talk way better about this and Matt Baer and some of the guys that went 25, 30 deep. And you're high-fiving strangers. You're hugging strangers. Everybody. It just brings 500,000 people together to celebrate one common victory.
I could take Gordie Howe, Alex Delvecchio, Terry Sawchuk, any of the old hockey players and hockey players
that had no masks and had no helmets.
Yeah, no kidding.
Terry Sawchuk was our goalie, and he had 100 stitches in his face.
They didn't believe in masks and helmets.
No, there were no masks. And then you know how the goalie poles move when you run into them? They cemented them in.
They were.
You run into those things, you're gonna get.
You're done. Because now they're like there's magnets or whatever. They hit and they just come off. You know.
But you, they were different. They were people that when you met them, they'd say, "Let's go have a beer." Mm-hmm. I mean, and don't get me wrong, old style baseball players were the same way.
Oh, okay? Yeah.
But hockey players, those guys, for the most part, come right off of, you know, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, Alberta. They come right off farms.
Yeah, and the last thing I'll comment is, you mentioned they'll make a movie about this someday.
Yes,
you would never, and this has been said a million times, say one more time, you would never a month ago, or let's say in January, say, okay, let's look at all these scenarios. You know, worst team, we're going to have a little girl that's a cancer victim, we're going to have a song, we're going to have a new interim coach, we're going to have a rookie goalie. You could just keep throwing stuff at the wall.
You're going to have fights during practice.
Right, you're going to start throwing stuff at the wall, and somebody writing a screenplay would be like, "Oh, come on, you're going way too far." You throw it all in there. All that happened, and that's what makes it even more unbelievable.
I said that to Ryan earlier. I'm like, this is actually one of the greatest success stories
it's a Rocky on ice. I mean, it is.
There's no doubt about it.
You know, it's just incredible.
And Berube put his stamp on these kids, and I guarantee you, he took this group of kids, made them believe in themselves, and actually played hockey the way you have to play Stanley Cup.
Well, I heard somebody real quick. I heard somebody with the Blues organization say that in December, around the Christmas time, they were basically going to be it was going to be wholesale. They were going to get rid of everybody except O'Reilly. I mean, everybody was ready to go out the door. You know, so there you go.
Great.
Go Blues.
Okay. Blues win again.
Go Blues. Yeah,
or Blues win Stanley Cup. That's all the time we have for sports talk. Take care of yourself the rest of the evening.